just to go over a little off the topic, but you know, the Shabbos, which is the Shabbos Mevorchim of Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni, we begin 4 special Torah readings. We normally do them in the month of Adar. This year we do it in the month of Adar Sheni. That is Parsha Shkalim. We have a Maftir. This is the Maftir. The Parsha of the week is the regular Parsha of the week. But we have the Maftir of Parsha Shkalim, giving the half shekel. And then right before Purim, we have Parshas Zohar, the mitzvah of remembering Amalek, and that's the story of Shmuel and David, Shaul was supposed to kill Amalek. Then we have Parshas Parah, the Parsha of Parah Aduma. And then the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nisan, we have Parshas HaChodesh, which talks about the laws of Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So if you think about it, Lefi Pshuto, these three Parshios, or these three Maftirs, or these 4 Parshios, these 4 Haftoros, they really represent 3 unrelated themes. For example, Parsha Shkolim. Why do I read about the Machtis HaShekel? Because every single year, a Jew is supposed to give a half shekel towards the upkeep of the Beis HaMikdash. And that half shekel was used for the sacrifices. So what does that have to do with Adar? Because the fiscal year of the Beis HaMikdash begins from Nisan. That means starting from Nisan, all korbanos have to be purchased from newly collected money. You could not use old money to buy the korbanos. So starting from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, it needed to be newly collected money. So they would start collecting the money 1 month before by Adar. So by the time Nisan came along, there was enough newly collected money to buy the korbanos. And then throughout the year, people would send in their half shkalim. What do you do with the old money? What if there's a surplus? What if there's leftover money that was collected from last year, which sometimes happened? So the Mishnah in shkalim has all sorts of accounting rules. What do you do with the extra shkalim? You cannot use last year's money for korbanos like the Tamid or the Musaf. You can use it to repair the city, you can use it for optional offerings, but korbanos of obligation must come from newly collected money. And that is why we read Parsha Shkolim, the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar, to commemorate that that is when they would begin to collect the half shekel. Now that idea has nothing to do with Purim and nothing to do with Pesach. It's simply based on the idea that the fiscal year of the temple begins Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Right, so that's Parsha Shkolim, meaning it's unrelated to the holiday cycle. It just happens to be that that's the time of year when we would start collecting the half shekel. Now, Parsha Zohar, remembering Amalek, which is, we read the Torah portion about Amalek, and we read the Haftorah about Shaul being commanded. That is connected to Purim, because although the mitzvah of destroying Amalek applies all the time, but Haman, we know, is from Amalek, and Haman's downfall commemorates or symbolizes the defeat of Amalek, so that's why we read Parsha Zohar at that point. So Parsha Zohar seems to be connected to Purim. Parsha Shkolim is neither connected to Purim nor Pesach. Parsha Zohar seems to be connected to Purim. Now Parsha Parah, which is read after Purim, that talks about the purification of the red heifer, that if a person was a Tamei Nes, he had to be purified by being sprinkled with ashes on the 3rd and on the 7th day after his contact with Tumah. That's exactly why today, if any of us have ever been in a cemetery, we can never be purified unless we're sprinkled with the heifer of the Parah, which is why, among other things, we cannot go in the Temple Mount because we have the status of a Tamei. Now remember that not every tumah needs parah aduma. For example, if you're tameh because of a dead animal, or you're tameh because of a seminal emission, or a woman is tameh because she's a nida, the afer, the ashes of parah aduma are not necessary for that. But for a tumah that comes from being in contact with a Jewish dead body, whether it's in a cemetery or directly or in the same roof or whatever, the only way you can be purified is by the ashes of the parah aduma.
What would be the difference between a Jewish dead body and a non-Jewish dead body if the soul is left?
Yeah, so the basic idea is that the concept of impurity when a soul leaves is a function of the holiness of the body when the soul was in there. Meaning to say, the greater the holiness, the greater the void. So paradoxically, again, I'm not comparing non-juicy animals, but you see the same pattern. A dead human being conveys more impurity than a dead animal. Mm-hmm. If I touch a dead human being, I'm tummy for 7 days. If I touch a dead animal, I'm only tummy for 1 day.
Because of the void.
The answer is, the greater the holiness. So the same idea, actually let me qualify it a little bit, because I didn't completely express it. The same idea that says that the tumma of a human is greater and more severe than the tumma of an animal also applies to a slightly lesser degree that the tumma of a Jewish corpse is greater than the tumma of a non-Jewish corpse. Because once again, tumma is the vacuum or the void that is created when holiness leaves. Now, let me just explain this. If I touch a dead animal, I'm only tummy for 1 day. And all I have to do, even today, is go to the mikveh. There's no sacrifice I have to bring, and there's no para aduma that I need, etc. By the way, just one question you might ask. How could I say a dead animal, this is obvious, but sometimes you get mixed up. I say a dead animal makes me tummy. Well, how could a kohen eat meat? You know, meat is a dead animal, right? That's what vegetarians like to say. I don't, like to eat dead animals. No, that's nice. but the answer is halakhically the following. Any animal that was properly shechted does not have tumah. Okay, so kosher meat that is properly slaughtered does not convey any impurity. So even a kohen, even in the Beis HaMikdash, obviously we brought korbanos. So when I say a dead animal makes you tameh, I either mean the animal wasn't shechted, it was like roadkill, or it was just your non-kosher meat. Beef that was shot is tameh, roadkill is tameh, and non-kosher animals that die, like a dead pig or a dead rat, would be tameh.
They found the soul later?
Huh?
They found that after they shechted it,
Yeah. So this is an interesting concept. The interesting concept is, this is machlokas tanaim. If you did a proper shechita on a kosher animal, but it was a trefa, there was some defect in the lung, according to many opinions, it still does not convey tuma. In other words, the shechita has the effect of taking away the tuma. Okay, so a dead animal is only tamei 1 day, and I don't need paraduma. Now, if I touch a dead corpse, and this makes no difference if it's a Jewish or non-Jewish, I am tamei for 7 days, and I have to be sprinkled with the para aduma. So what did I mean before when I said that the tuma of a Jewish corpse is more severe? I mean the following idea, that in order for a non-Jewish corpse to make me tamei, I have to actually touch it. If I'm in the same room with it, under the same roof, or I'm in a non-Jewish cemetery, I don't become tamei. As opposed to a Jewish corpse conveys tumah not only by touching the corpse, but also by being under the same roof, or being in a cemetery, or even if you're an overhanging tree, right? That's the problem we have with driving around here, or even in the States. The halacha is, if you have a tree that overhangs a grave and the road, and you drive your car under that tree, you become tamei because you're under the common roof. Now, let me emphasize again, just in terms of halacha, there is no aveira for a Yisrael or a Levi to become tamei. However, if you are tamei, you're not allowed to enter the temple. You can't enter the Temple Mount. So the only consequence of every one of us being tamei is that we're not allowed to enter the Har HaBayis. And when there's a temple, we won't be able to go to the temple until we have the sprinkling of the paraduma. But there's no aveira that you've committed. As opposed to a kohen is different. A kohen has a prohibition to come in contact with a corpse dead, not with an animal, but with a human corpse. So the kohen would have to be careful not to drive under the tree that overhangs the grave. You might as well do that if you're not a kohen, because there's no aveira that you're doing anyway.
What about if the tumah is from a kohen?
So So for a guy, so they say, it's a machlokes, how we paskin, but many poskin paskin that the tuma of a goy only conveys by touching and not by being under the same roof, not by tumas ohel. Some are machmer, yes, that's right. So the Ramah actually says, l'chatchila, a kohen should not enter a non-Jewish cemetery either, but b'dievet, it could be. That might be with the evidence. There might be the evidence if it's an important reason to go. We could be make a lot of it. This is the story. I think I may have mentioned this in the what's called the Golden Gate, right? You have the Kotel, right? The Kotel is the western wall of Har Habayis. But if you go all the way to the other side, the Kidron Valley and the Mount of Olives. So you'll notice there are two gates in the wall, the east wall of the Temple Mount. And those gates are blocked up. They're not used. They're not usable gates. In other words, they were once gates. You can see them as gates, but they're not used gates. And they're called the Golden Gates. And according to various Midrashim, the Mashiach is going to come from the Har HaZeisim, the Mount of Olives, down to the Kidron Valley and enter the Temple Mount through those Golden Gates. Har HaZeisim. That's correct. Mashiach will go through Har HaZeisim and the like. Now you will also notice, if you look closely, that there is a small Muslim cemetery right up to the Golden Gates. They have the Kidron Valley, and the Mount of Olives, of course, is a huge Jewish cemetery, but then there's a Muslim cemetery right up there. I don't know if that's a special honor to be buried there or whatever it is, but it's right outside the Golden Gates. So I once heard from a tour guide many years ago, I don't know if there's a mucker for this, that the Muslims built a cemetery there because they know that Eliyahu HaNavi is supposed to announce the coming of Mashiach. And Eliyahu HaNavi, according to Chazal, is a reincarnation of Pinchas the Kohen. So they bedavka put a cemetery there so that Pinchas will be unable, Eliyahu will be unable to announce Mashiach through the Golden Gate, and as a result, Mashiach will not be able to come. This was the Muslim thinking. Now, the thinking is not MS, number for a lot. I mean, there are millions. First of all, Eliyahu Navi is not going to be limited to one gate. It's not like, can't do that gate, Moshiach is not going to come. So we'll figure out another gate. Or Hashem could just destroy the cemetery, in one second. But halachically, too, we actually paskin Meikar
Hadin,
that they're non-Jews. So Eliyahu Navi would be allowed to walk through that cemetery anyway. So it's funny that the Muslims have so much. It's true that the truth is a lot of the ancient cultures knew a lot of these midrashim. They knew these traditions. They knew these different stories and aspects of Judaism. They knew it more than Jews know it today, and they respond accordingly in negative ways. So that's the thing about a kohen. So again, the point I want to make is that on one level, the four parshios, each one of them is moving in a different direction. Parsha Shkalim has nothing to do with Purim or Pesach. Parsha Zohar is connected to Purim. Parsha Parah is simply because the one korban that every single person had to bring was the korban Pesach. So you had to be sure you were pure, so people would start getting sprinkled, with the Parah Aduma in case they were tamei during the course of the year. So Parah Aduma is the necessary preparation for Pesach. And then the final one is Parshas HaChodesh, which goes over the different laws of Pesach, Matzah, Maror, etc. So it would seem, therefore, Shkalim is not connected to Purim or Pesach. Parshas Zohar is Purim. And Parah and Chodesh are 2 weeks that have nothing to do with Adar, really. But they're read in Adar as preliminary to the month of Nisan. Right? This is the simple understanding of how all of this works. By the way, I think we talked about this. Parah Aduma has a great, great conundrum. Because here's the thing. None of us can be Tohor until we are sprinkled with the ashes of Parah Aduma. But in order to sprinkle us with the ashes of Parah Aduma, you need a Kohen that is Tohor. So let's imagine we miraculously had a Parah Aduma even today. Every few years they claim to discover a Parah Aduma, and they're so excited. and they say it means Mashiach is coming. And then what usually happens is after a while it develops. The Parah Aduma has to be totally red. Now it's not firehouse red. You're never going to get a cow firehouse red like a fire truck. But you know, red in terms of a reddish brown is a color that's actually quite common in cows. It's not intrinsically a rare thing. But what's rare is it has to be 100%, and you're only allowed one black hair. So someone would have to laboriously take a magnifying glass and go over, you know, every inch. Now, commonly, if you're familiar with the cows, the reddish brown normally has white, right? A very common color of cows is it's reddish brown, and then there's like white splotches. That wouldn't be acceptable. So what happens is when they find this Parah Aduma, they invariably discover there's more than one. There are two, three black hairs. No good. So Shaila, well, can't I just pluck it out? Okay, but basically once you have your two hairs, you know, you're stuck. It's no good even if you pluck it out afterwards. But the problem halakhically is, let's say we would have our Parah Aduma. Let's say we found it 100%. Let's say we genetically engineered a Parah Aduma. There's even a discussion. Maybe we can do that. But who on earth is going to be able to be the Tohar Kohen? Because you can't sprinkle it on people until you're pure. But there's nobody who's pure. So there was an attempt, based on a description in the Mishnah, to kind of isolate children who, from the beginning of their lives, were never exposed to any type of possibility of Tamei Meis. This involved, you know, going to a cliff, a rocky place where there might not be a subterranean, because in any dirt there might be a body, especially in Israel. There are dead bodies everywhere. There might be dead bodies where we're standing right now. I mean, there are so many ancients. Every time they do construction here, they find bones. But they move to a rocky, when the women are pregnant, they would move to a rocky cliff, and they would raise children, and the parents couldn't even touch the kids, because if the parent is tummy, the child will become tummy, right? So they would, like the way you treat kids who have diseases or whatever it is, you know, they would touch them through gloves, and they'll bubble, all that. So there were actually 50 women who volunteered to when they were pregnant, to raise their kids this way, in preparation. No, I'm talking about maybe 15 years ago. There was a messianic fervor to do this. You know, there's a messianic fervor. There's a group of people. Yeah. Well, it wasn't Chabad, but it was. The police got involved. The police broke it up because of child abuse. Yes. So they couldn't do it. But the short answer is that. At least this is where Eliyahu HaNavi comes into play. Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen, and because he's in Shemayim, he did not become ritually impure. So he will come back to earth, he will make that first Parah Aduma, and he will be able to purify us from the Parah Aduma that'll be there. Now, you may ask, huh? Yes, but he left the world in a state of purity, because when he was there was still Parah Aduma. So he left the world in a Tohar state. See, you may ask, well, so how does that ever work? Whenever we had a new Parah Aduma, who was the Kohen that... But the short answer is, normally you always had, when you had a new Parah Aduma to make, you always had leftover ashes from an old Parah Aduma. So the Kohen would be sprinkled with the last remnants of the old, and then he would be able to do the new. Our problem today is that if we get a new one, we don't have any remnant of an old, and we don't have any person who can do the sprinkling, right? Because you have nobody to start, because that's where Leo and Nabi is going to come in.
So what did they do when I came back from Bobo?
There were people who were Tor. See, here's the thing. You don't need, this is an important thing that people don't realize, you actually don't need a Beis HaMikdash for the ritual of Parah Aduma. Even in Golus, we were able to keep the Parah Aduma and be sprinkled with its ashes and be Tor. So there were people, in fact, even in the time of the Tanoim after the Korban, and even in the time of the Amoraim, there was still the ashes of the Parah Aduma. In other words, you don't need a Beis HaMikdash per se to sprinkle the ashes of the Parah Aduma. Okay. But it's a biggie. The fact that we don't have it is exactly why we cannot enter the Temple Mount, Bismanasa.
So, if it's back to the idea of a dead non-kosher animal,
yes.
Like if there's a dead rat in your house, you can just use gloves or something to remove it, or...
As a matter of fact, that's correct. If I move a dead rat with gloves, I do not become tummy.
Okay.
That's correct.
And then with the idea of plucking the hairs from the red heifer,
yes.
If someone were to do that before calling in, you know, the rabbis to come check it out, how would you verify it from that?
Well, you know, I guess if we don't know, we wouldn't know. But strictly speaking, if we knew that's what he did, it would be puzzle. So in a sense, it is puzzle, but he could fool us, and then we just wouldn't know.
Why would there have been more red heifers back then than there are now?
Well, I don't think there were more. They were always very rare, and in fact, it's a very famous Gemara. You know this famous story about a non-Jew. Dama ben Nesina, and the Gemara uses him as an example of a person who honored his father to the greatest level. One time they needed a jewel in the Kohen Gadol's breastplate, and it was a very expensive jewel, and he was the one who had the jewel. But the key to the jewelry box was under his father's pillow. So he did not wake up his father, although he lost a huge amount of money in the sale, because he did not want to give his father pain, although I have a comment in that story in a moment. And then it says, in reward for that, he was given a para aduma in his flock the next year. And he was able to get as much money as he would have gotten for the jewel. And they even offered him more money. He said he didn't want to take any more than he would have made on the jewel.
He was a non-Jew?
He was a non-Jew. And Chazal quote him as the exemplar of the person who honors his father. Now, the problem I have with that story is that I don't think Dad would be that happy. I mean, let's imagine, let's imagine your situation. Let's imagine somebody offers you, $20 million, but you'd have to wake up your father. So you don't wake him up. And they say, Dad, I didn't want to disturb your nap, but I just thought we lost the $20 million. Abba would not.
I love you, Dad.
Yeah, he would not be so happy with that. So according to halacha, if you're asking me, la halacha, should I wake up my father if someone's offering us even $1 million or even less than that? I would say, the halacha is very pungent. If your father would want to be woken up, you wake him up. So the way you have to understand the Gemara is not making the point that halachically he did the right thing. Halachically he did the wrong thing. But it does show how committed he was to honoring his father. The fact that, he didn't know the halacha, he wasn't following the halacha. But the fact that he was willing to lose a huge amount of money shows that he deeply respected his father. So essentially we're admiring the attitude that he had as opposed to the actual thing that he did. So halakhically, if you were to be confronted with a similar situation, unless your father basically said, no matter what, don't wake me up, but usually 99 out of 100 times, their father would want to be woken up, so you actually wake him up. Under those circumstances. But I'm just bringing in that story to show that the para aduma was a very, very expensive thing. Yeah. Okay, so now, though, what I want to share with you is the idea that even though it appears that the para aduma, that the four parshios are totally unrelated, different things, in fact, there is one unifying theme that cuts across the board. And this thought is from Rav Tzadok of Lublin. And Rav Tzadok of Lublin basically teaches, he was a great Hasidic Rebbe, one of the deepest Hasidic thinkers. He died in the year 1900, so the very beginning of the 20th century. And Rav Tzadok says that essentially the four parshios, the four special Torah readings, are a spiritual preparation for Pesach. Pesach is called the season of liberation. And it's liberation from slavery. But slavery is understood not merely as physical bondage, but slavery is to be redeemed from whatever it is that is binding us and constricting us. Remember the important idea that the word Mitzrayim, which is translated as Egypt, can also mean limitation, constriction, boundary. Right, remember the passage in the Haggadah? Each person must regard himself as if they themselves were taken out of Mitzrayim. And the question is, what does that mean? I was never in Mitzrayim. Do I just pretend that I was a slave? In what sense does each person regard himself as if they were taken out of Mitzrayim? So the Baal HaTanya writes that Mitzrayim refers to the inner slavery of a person. And each person must recognize that they too have an inner Mitzrayim. And the same way God put the spiritual powers into the world that liberates us, liberated us from that slavery, Hashem puts in a power in the world that liberates us from our own inner Mitzrayim. So we actually experience Yetzias Mitzrayim by tapping into that spiritual energy. So a person could have a Mitzrayim of egotism, of selfishness, of arrogance, of anger, of a lack of self-esteem, a lack of faith in themselves. All of that is a Mitzrayim. It blocks me. It constricts me. It ties me up. And Yetzias Mitzrayim is Hashem allows me to be liberated from that Mitzrayim. This is the Baal HaTanya. So Rav Tzadok says, if you understand that Pesach is about inner spiritual liberation, then we can look at the four parshios as steps or precursors in order to liberate ourselves from our spiritual slavery. Now, how is that so? So Rav Tzadok basically says the following. I'm going to carry this over. Basically, there are three primary enslavers of the human personality. We'll see where you get the fourth one. And those three are enumerated in Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Eliezer HaKapor says, Hakina v'hataiva v'hakavot motzien es ha'adam min ha'olam. Okay, very famous and important Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Kina. Kina is jealousy or envy. Taiva is lust, hedonistic lust for sensual and material pleasure. And kavod is the need for incessant ego gratification and self-glorification. These three things take a person out of the world. Jealousy, lust, and kavod. Motzien es ha'adam min ha'olam. This is the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Which world did it take you out of? So this is interesting. To take you out of Olam Haba, for sure it does. You're not going to get Olam Haba if you're filled with these bad midas. But what's interesting is, the Mishnah also means it makes your life in this world awful. In other words, not only don't you get your Olam Haba, you don't even get your Olam Hazeh. Because it's obvious, is it not, that if you're consumed with jealousy, because you're always looking at what other people have, you'll never enjoy the blessings that Hashem will give you. In the very middle of your enjoying, you know, you're enjoying your steak. Somebody else has filet mignon, right? So I can't enjoy it, you know, because somebody has something better. Right? So jealousy is constantly going to eat you up. Taiva, once again, if you're always lusting, as Chazal say, he who has 100 wants 200. Once you hit 200, you want 400. Meaning to say, when you live on that modality of always wanting more, you know, you're never happy. I mean, the people that have, $1 billion don't retire. You know, they're looking for $4 billion, whatever it is. Like, how many, you know, how much do you need? Once you have a 30-room house, you know, what exactly do you move up to, you know, et cetera. And kavod is the worst thing of all. Because kavod, the Bali Musar say, you know, consider a beggar that's begging around for pennies. If a person needs kavod, meaning he needs the acclaim of the crowds, he needs people's approval all the time. Now, he'll be like a beggar, constantly needing that approval, constantly needing that applause. Right? A person has to have a sense, ultimately, of an inner self-esteem in his relationship with Hashem, in which, you know, your well-being does not depend on, you know, people's acclamation. There needs to be a certain containment in a person. And that way, you know, you don't have the highs or the lows, because when you're in a kavod mentality, you know, you need the approbation, and when you don't get that approbation, you know, you feel crushed. Right? This way, you could take it one way or the other. You know, your head is not swelled when you get the applause, and you're not crushed when you don't get it. So those are the big three, kina, taiva, v'kavod. So structurally, what Rav Tzadok says is the following. I'm just going to set out the structure of the thought, and then we'll develop it in the course of the week. Parsha Shkalim helps us deal with jealousy. Kina. Parshas Zachor helps us deal with taiva, lust. Parshas Para helps us deal with kavod. And if we've worked on the big three, we're then ready for the fourth week, which is Chodesh. And Chodesh, which means Rosh Chodesh Nisan, but could also mean renewal. Then you're ready to be renewed. When you've eradicated the kina, the taiva, and the kavod, you're ready for what is called his chad shus. Okay? Now, we'll explain that tonight. I'm going to hold it over next time. But I just want you to get the structure. You can start thinking about it yourself. In other words, you see Rav Tzedek's point. Instead of looking at the four parshios as haphazard dates that are not associated with each other. Shkolim has nothing to do with anything. And Zohar is Purim. And Parah and Chodesh are Pesach connected. He says all of them are Pesach connected because Pesach is about liberating yourself from your own inner Mitzrayim. And in order to liberate myself, I have to cleanse myself from the negative attributes of Kina, Taiva, Kavod. And then I'm ready to be renewed and liberated. And that's exactly the trajectory. Shkolim is Kina, Zohar is Taiva, Parah is Kavod. Then you're ready for his Chachas. I'll just point out, and we'll develop each of these, but I just want to point out that the reason why Shkolim is first in this hierarchy is jealousy is the most difficult meter to combat. And consequently, you need the most time to overcome it. And that's why it comes first in the pantheon of things that you have to eliminate. So this Shabbos is going to be the Parsha Shkolim, because it's the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar, and when you have two Adars, it's the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni. So this Shabbos, we're going to be focusing on the idea of jealousy and how the Machzis HaShekel combats that. By the way, I think I mentioned this to you, but it's a nice little riddle. Can you come up with a case where two boys that are born the same year, and one boy is younger than the other boy, but he's going to have his bar mitzvah first? Right? Can you figure out that case? When will a younger child become bar mitzvah before an older child? It doesn't work. That's correct. No, not even minishmashmas. I'll give you a simpler case. Let's imagine two boys are born in a leap year. So one boy is born the 20th of Adar Aleph. And the other boy is born 3 weeks later, the 10th of Adar Beis. So the second boy was born 3 weeks later. 13 years later, there is only one Adar. So if you're born in a leap year, and your bar mitzvah year is only one Adar, then whatever day in either the first or the second Adar is going to be your bar mitzvah in the single Adar. So, the kid who was born the 20th of Adar Aleph will have his bar mitzvah the 20th of Adar. And the kid that was born the 10th of Adar Beis is going to have his bar mitzvah the 10th of Adar. So the kid that was born 3 weeks later is going to have his bar mitzvah 10 days earlier. Okay, it's kind of a nice little riddle that the younger person could actually have his bar mitzvah first, but that only works if the bar mitzvah year is a non-leap year. If the bar mitzvah year is a leap year, then you're going to work the same way. The one that was born the 20th of Adar Aleph, his bar mitzvah is the 20th of Adar Aleph, and the one that's born the 10th of Adar Beis, his bar mitzvah will be the 10th of Adar Beis. Okay? Now with the yard site, it's an interesting machlokas. Let's say, okay, so once again, if somebody died in a leap year, and any given year, there's only one Adar, so you simply observe the yard site in the one Adar. That's not a problem. Similarly, if somebody died in a leap year, and any given year is a leap year, so you observe it the exact one, either Aleph or Beis. But the big question that we have is, let's say somebody died in a somebody died in a regular Adar. So when do you observe a yahrzeit in a leap year? Right, somebody died in a regular Adar. When do you observe the Yahrzeit in the leap year? Now, logic would indicate that it ought to be the second Adar, because that's really the month of Adar. Adar Aleph is the makeup. And yet, the Rama says, our minhag is, it's a machlokas, that we observe Yahrzeit in the first Adar, because we don't want to pass by the mitzvah. So it's proper, actually, that if somebody is observing Yahrzeit for a parent who died in the month of Adar, in a leap year, one should keep the Yahrzeit twice, to be able to say all of the different days. Okay, so we'll continue with Rav Tzedek's thought. Yes, that's very true. We'll discuss that too. There is a machlokes if Parshas Par is the Oraisa. So there's a minority view that Parshas Par is the Oraisa. The majority view is Parshas Zohar is the Oraisa. Yep, for sure. Well, the parsha. Okay, so don't be confused, because the word parsha here is being used in two different ways. The parsha of the week is Parshas Pikudei.
Okay.
But there will be a special additional Torah reading, an additional Torah reading, that is called the Parsha of Shekalim. In other words, you're going to see that they're going to take out two Torah scrolls.
Double portion?
No, it's not a double portion. It's only one extra thing. In other words, next week we're only reading Pikudei is the parsha of the week. That's it. But after seven people are called to the Torah, and we have Maftir, which is the extra Torah reading, we're going to read a small, not a whole parsha. We're just going to read a small portion of around 10 verses that deal with the mitzvah of giving the half shekel. Okay, so it's not a double parsha, but there will be two Torah scrolls. It's a special maftir, it's called, a special maftir. So these are going to be four special weeks. So the four special weeks do not interrupt the parsha of the week. You're going to keep on doing the parsha of the week, but it's just an additional maftir. After the seven people are called to the Torah, there'll be a small Torah reading.
Replacing the haftarah.
Well, it doesn't replace the Haftorah, it'll be a special Haftorah. It'll replace the normal Haftorah with another Haftorah.
Replacing the normal Haftorah.
That's correct. But also, they'll be reading from the Torah as well, a Torah reading and a new Haftorah. So we're not going to read, so this Shabbos, we're not going to read the Haftorah of Parshas Pekudei. We're going to read the Haftorah of Parshas Shkolim, it's called.
Okay.
Yeah, and you'll see this. So Shkolim.
This week we're going
to... So as a result, we give a special name to these weeks. We call it Parshas Shekalim, although that's not the Parsha per se. Parshas Shekalim, okay? Now, what's a little strange is, we actually read the verses of Parshas Shekalim just 2 weeks ago. We're reading it again. Yeah, the half shekel was the beginning of Kisisa, but that'll be the Parshas Shekalim that we're going to read. We're going to read that part of it again, okay?
Which is the first Aliyah, isn't it?
It's the very first Aliyah, but we're going to read less than, in other words, the first Aliyah is very big in Kisisa. We're only going to read like 10 verses from it. So it's not a lot. It doesn't add a lot of time to davening. So don't worry about that. It's not a double parsha. Now, most weeks, Vayakel and Pekudei are actually read as a double parsha. And that's the largest parsha in the Torah when they're combined. It's the largest combination. But when it's a leap year, because you have extra Shabbos, it's separated. So that's why last Shabbos was Vayakel, and this Shabbos is Pekudei. Mm-hmm. In a regular year, it's Vayakel Pekudei. Because you have fewer weeks, right? A leap year adds four Shabboses to the Jewish calendar.
There's no double portions.
No double portions this year. In a leap year, you know, because that's exactly the point. In a leap year, you don't have double portions because you need to stretch it out. But you still have the four special Torah readings. That you never lose. You always have the four special readings of Shkolim, Zohar, Parah, and Chodesh. Okay? Yeah.
Is there a reason it's so connected to Tetzava? Or it seems very repetitive, this Pekudei?
Well, the basic idea, just the simple idea, is that Parshas Truma and Tetzava is God speaking to Moshe, telling them what he should command the Jewish people. Vayakel Pekudei is the Jewish people actually carrying it out. So it does seem like there's a lot of repetition, but the Torah really wants to praise the Jewish people that they carried out in great detail
Couldn't you say they did what God said?
You're 100% correct. And the Torah could have said that. That would have saved a lot of verses.
Yeah.
But the commentaries say that God is expressing a very important idea, that when you express gratitude to somebody, you should be specific. You shouldn't just say, thanks for everything. But you kind of say, thank you for A and B and C. It's like Hashem is saying thank you to the Jewish people for faithfully carrying out their job. You're 100% correct. There's a tremendous amount of apparent repetition. Because, you know, God says to Moshe, do A, B, C, D through Z. And then Vayakal Bakudeh says, and the Jewish people did A, B, C, D. It could have just said, the Jewish people did everything that God commanded. Mm-hmm. One verse. 100% correct. It's an excellent question. But the answer is, Hashem is teaching you, when you say thank you, be specific. Mm-hmm. Because Hashem is specific when he gives Hakaras HaTov to the Jewish people.
Mashiach coming from Har Zeisim isn't a problem.
That's not such a problem, because the Emes is a Kohen is allowed to be in a cemetery as long as he's 4 cubits. Four amos from the grave. So there are pathways on the Mount of Olives you can walk, a Kohen can walk through. But he has to be careful about the trees.
Yeah. That's ridiculous is that they're playing to our rules. If they think it's real, what are they doing?
It's a lose-lose.
No,
there's a Yiddish expression, Geisha Kup. But you find this all sorts of midrashim about Nebuchadnezzar, Ahasuerus, Haman, like Haman, right? Haman drew lots to pick the best month to kill the Jewish people. Remember that? And he was so happy when he got the month of Adar. Right? He drew lots. Which is the month? Why was he so happy? Because Moshe Rabbeinu died on the 7th of Adar, and therefore it's a bad month for the Jews. So Haman believed that the fact that Moshe died in the month of Adar makes Adar a bad month. His mistake was Moshe was born in the month of Adar too, so it's a good month for the Jews. Right? So Haman only knew half of the picture.